Outlet Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome along to today's edition of The Profile with me, Justin Brierley. This is the programme that brings you interviews with Christians in all walks of life. And you can find more interviews at Premier Christianity Magazine. If you'd like a free sample copy of the latest edition, go to premierchristianity.com/free sample. Well, today on The Profile, I'll be speaking to two people, both involved in multicultural ministry. One of them is Reverend Israel Olofinjana. He has the unusual experience of having been a black minister to a predominantly white congregation. We'll hear from him in the second part of today's show. But in this first segment, I'm speaking to Malcolm Patton. Today on The Profile, I'm joined by the Reverend Dr. Malcolm Patton. He's senior pastor at Blackhorse Road Baptist Church in Walthamstow, that's in East London. He's previously ministered at churches in Tottenham and Croydon. And his doctoral thesis was based on research into multicultural ministry. In fact, his new book, published by SBCK, is titled Leading a Multicultural Church. So welcome along to the programme, Malcolm.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with me. You're a Baptist minister.
Yeah.
Did you kind of grow up Baptist? Was that your route?
Yes, I grew up in the Baptist church in a council house estate in Hartlepool. It was a church that my mother actually had been found a member of as the estate was being built, and they decided to plant a ministry there. My father became a Christian after his father died, and he was invited along to the church. And they came together, and
the rest is history.
That's where I grew up.
So you experienced a call, I guess, at some point in your life. Was that as an adult, or did you kind of have that from a young age?
No, we actually had an American youth pastor for a year when I was about 15, and he had a big impact on my life and was building the youth ministry. Suddenly became very dynamic, and he challenged me about whether I was simply following in the footsteps of my parents coming to church, or whether I actually believed in who Jesus was and was committed to following Christ. And that led me to a period of reflection on that, and then I just felt a growing sense within me that Jesus was who he said he was, and that if he wasn't then I might as well stop going to church. But if he was who he said he was, then that demands everything of me. And so from that point on, he encouraged me, discipled me. When he went back to the States, I kind of picked up some of the leadership responsibilities. And by the time I was about 20, 21, feeling the call to ministry, and I think I was 23 years old when I went off to train at Spurgeon's Baptist College.
Yeah, so Spurgeon's being Spurgeon's in London.
Yeah.
But you weren't from London. Was it a big change for you going to the down south?
Yeah, it was a dramatic change. I thought I'd come a long way coming from the northeast to London. I remember my area minister saying to me, why don't you go to Manchester? And I thought, if I'm going to leave Hartlepool, I want to go to London. You know, I want to be there. So I went there and I thought I'd come a long way. And I looked around and I hadn't come any distance at all.
Right.
Because I found I was surrounded by people who'd crossed the planet to be here.
Yeah.
And that just completely blew my mind, really.
It was a really cosmopolitan kind of melting pot of different nationalities.
Yeah, the different nationalities, the diversity of it all. And I experienced that in the college, who became my closest friends. One was from Trinidad, one was from Nigerian British. And in my student placement church, just trying to do church, but with people, you know, you always have people of different ages and different, perhaps social, economic backgrounds are used to that, but bringing the ethnic diversity into
it. Was this the first time really you were encountering Christians from Africa, the Caribbean, other parts of the world?
Yeah, there were a few people who would, mainly because of the hospital, who would come and do a placement at the hospital in Hartlepool and maybe come along to the church, you know. I have memories of occasional people, you know, say from the Philippines who were working in the hospital. My parents were very enthusiastic about world missions, so we often had the missionaries stay in our house and come and tell us the stories, and shows photographs of things. And so in a sense, I had this world view. I think I dreamt of traveling the world. And when I came to London, I found my niche, if you like, and my calling amongst seeking to build multicultural churches.
Obviously, these were fellow Christians. What did you find different, though, about the way they worshipped, the way they thought about God, that perhaps wasn't part of your experience up to that point?
Yeah, I think the people's customs, traditions, birth, weddings, funerals were very, very different. Mm. You know, I'd only ever been to funerals, a kind of traditional English funeral. Mm. And the idea of, I remember as if it was yesterday, the first time I did a funeral where they said the coffin was going to be open.
Mm. And that traditional from the Caribbean specifically, or
from Africa? From Africa would be very common. And other places too. And, you know, that wasn't something that was part of my experience. And I remember thinking, how am I going to cope?
Know? We like to shut away the dead person, don't we?
Yeah. I began to appreciate the different, what the different perspectives offered, what the different ways of doing things offered. Mm. Like you say, you can kind of shut yourself away from that, but they, you know, would be much more likely to be involved in that and dressing.
My wife, who also ministered, having not really had much experience in multicultural ministry for a year in a church in Tottenham, actually, this was one of the things that really struck her, was her first time experiencing a funeral and the mourning that accompanied it in a family that were, I think, originally from Africa. And there was a sort of an open house thing going on, and people would just come through the course of the day. And the children weren't excluded. The children were there. And often, I think, in a more white Western sort of culture, we tend to kind of shield children from the reality of death and all of that. But this was all very much open. There were emotions being expressed very openly. But there was actually something very honest and real she found about that, compared to the way often in a perhaps Western British context, you tend to sort of try and sanitize it all a bit. So was that your experience at all?
And that is very much. And, you know, you would sometimes find yourself being invited in. You know, it's typical, for example, people from Jamaica, they would have this ninth night after the person had passed, and people would come round to the house, and there'd be a kind of expectation that the minister might lead with a scripture or prayer, or so you're finding your way, and you're having to you know, just sense what role do I play in that setting, which is different and unusual. Other ways as well. I mean, I found that often people from other cultures would insist on calling you pastor or minister. They wouldn't want to use your first name, Malcolm.
Right. A sense of reverence, respect.
Respect, hierarchy.
Which you felt a little bit uncomfortable with.
Yeah, I think to begin with, you think, please call me Malcolm, call me Malcolm. But I want to call you pastor. Mm. And I remember thinking about this with my colleague, Rupert, when we were in Croydon. And we talked about this. And in the end, we decided that we would use Pastor Rupert, Pastor Malcolm, or Rupert Malcolm in the news sheet, so that people could feel free.
Right.
If they wanted to call us Pastor or Pastor Malcolm, they feel free to call us Pastor Malcolm. If you want to just call me Malcolm, that's okay as well. And I think that was part of the negotiation, if you like, in terms of figuring out how to operate within a multi-ethnic environment.
Now, generally speaking, churches in the UK, probably in the USA as well, are often split down different colour lines.
Right.
Churches that are in the vast majority white, churches that may be in the vast majority black. That may be from different parts of the world, but nonetheless, there often are a black and a white church kind of thing going on. And normally you might expect to see a white church led by a white leader, a black church perhaps led by a black leader. Mm. Now, interestingly, I've spoken recently to an example that went against that, a black church leader leading a predominantly white church. And in your case, I suppose you have been a white church leader often leading predominantly black churches. Mm. Does that kind of involve any different kind of dynamic? What are the kind of issues that might bring up when the leader of the church is one colour and most of the people attending are of a different culture and colour themselves?
Yeah, it's probably slightly different if it's a predominantly white congregation with a black pastor than a black congregation or a mixed congregation following a white pastor. I think from the point of view that when people who are from, particularly those who are from the former British colonial countries, where they've been used to having white figureheads, and then they come into this country and they've adapted to the fact that their boss may be white and their head of the government may be white and the head of this may be white, the person in the bank is white. I remember one man telling me about the importance of taking his children to Antigua, where he was from, so that they could see that the head of the army, the head of the police, the head of the bank was black and Caribbean, so that they understood that they could aspire to these positions. But coming back to your question, I think the dynamics that we have to reflect on is how are people perceiving you? What dynamics do, if you're a white pastor like myself, are people treating me in a way equally? Because some people may kind of defer to you.
Yeah.
Some people may...
Because of a historic kind of association that there may be with...
Yeah.
With
that's how they did things in their own culture. They treated the pastor or the leader of the church.
And what's your response to that? Are you wanting to sort of try to go against that a bit, or say, okay, that's their culture, I guess that's the way it is? I mean, how do you kind of? I guess it's a tricky thing sometimes to navigate that.
I mean, looking at leadership, and I found it helpful drawing on a guy called Hofstede, who looked at organisations. He actually looked at IBM right across the world and how people in different cultures responded within organisations. And he talks about emotional distance, and that in countries, say, like Britain, we might have a low emotional distance. And what he means by that, or a low power distance, and what he means by that is that employees feel kind of, if not on an equal plane with their boss or their leader, fairly close and able to criticise, able to say, well, I don't think that we should do it that way. I think we should do it this way. And he observed that other cultures had a much wider power distance and therefore there was a reluctance to counter what was being said. And you find this when you're dealing with a leadership team. When you have a diverse leadership team, you begin to realise that there may be somebody who never really questions what you say. Mm. And I know one of my guys who is part of my leadership team, I would ask him what he thinks about something, and he would tell me a story from back home. Mm. And it's his way of kind of saying, well, we did it differently back home, but he's not going to say to me, well, I think you're doing it wrong. Right. I think this is a better way, or how about this? He'll just tell me a story and then say, you know, but it's fine, whatever you think.
Yeah.
And so I think it becomes a challenge for me to become aware of that, to what Hofstede calls this emotional distance, to become more vulnerable, more open, to say, well, actually, I think you're trying to tell me something about there's a different way that you used to do it or that you could suggest it could be helpful to us.
Yeah.
And for him to become more vulnerable, to say, it's okay, you can lay it out.
Yeah.
We're not trying to be each other, but we're trying to understand how each other tick and make it creatively positive, beneficial for us all.
Do you find yourself having to adapt the way you do a sermon, the kind of stories and references you might make, the way you lead worship generally, the way you minister to people as well, just on a pastoral level?
Yeah.
It's a big question, but what is that kind of gap and how do you cross it?
For me, coming down from the northeast into the southeast and into London is a cultural bridge in itself because I find that, you know, the culture of the northeast and the working class, the experience that we had of industries closing in the 70s and 80s when I was growing up, and the high unemployment, and coming out of that experience was quite a challenge coming down to London. Not a challenge in a sense, but you have a different perspective on life and politics and everything than sometimes people from the southeast. So in a sense, I have my own cultural bridge to cross and realise that people treat me differently because of my accent. When I first came to London, you know, people would think of Paul Gascoigne and Jimmy Nail, and you know, these were characters that weren't always the best example. I mean, okay, Paul Gascoigne's a great footballer, but off the field, so that's part of it, in the sense of my own journey. But also, I think that just how we hear one another, how we respond to one another, and how we overcome some of the prejudices that are there, because I think we all carry prejudices, and becoming aware of them and seeking to reduce our prejudices is very important.
How very often we're kind of blind to our prejudices, though. We often, people say, "Well, I'm not racist. I'm not prejudiced. Yeah. You know, I believe all people are equal." But but what are the ways in which we often don't tend to see our own prejudices in that way? I mean, did you have to learn to recognise your own sort of perhaps, you know, things you never realised were?
Yes, you do, and I think it's encouraged by the fact that sometimes we're a little bit afraid of how to approach people. You know, somebody has an accent that we're not used to, and we kind of think, oh, it's hard to understand what a person's saying. You can end up just avoiding that person because you don't want to be in the embarrassing situation of having to say, I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. Rather than throw yourself in and get used to it, such that after a little while, you hear it perfectly. And I think there's an example I use in the book, which I thought really summed up. I read some theory about how when we the way prejudice works is that we have our stereotypes. You know, we have an idea as to about people, and it may be because of ignorance. It may be because we've had a bad experience with some people, and we assume that everybody from that background is the same. But We might say, oh, well, Jamaican people are like this. But then we discover a Jamaican friend who's not like that. But then we think, oh, they're an exception. And then we discover another, we've got Jamaican neighbours, and we find that they're not like that either. But rather than change our stereotype, we stick with our stereotype and assume that everybody we're meeting is an exception to the rule. And I think that's, some people are able to see that and respond to it much more quickly and say, well, actually, maybe I'm not being fair to how I think Jamaican people are. Some people can be very stubborn and they'll stick with their stereotype, even though everybody they know from that cultural background actually is it doesn't really meet. Plus, I think as well, culture changes all the time. So, you know, my wife, who was from, her parents came over from Jamaica in the late 50s and early 60s. You know, my wife is different to them. She's grown up in this country. She's grown up in North London. So she can do the Jamaican thing. She can be, when she's at home, she talks a little bit more like them. She understands the culture and everything. But she also is a product of North London, in you know, and the television programs, the music, the things that she likes, the way she likes to dress will be more to do with a person of her age who's grown up in North London. And our child, it will be different again. She loves the fact that she's she has Jamaican grandparents, and she loves the fact that she has family in Hartlepool. But she, again, is a different generation, and she's grown up in a multicultural school, and so her outlook is different again. So I think also with prejudice, it's also realising that you can't... another example, a guy came into our congregation and a Nigerian guy, and I was immediately going to introduce him to other Nigerians in the church so that he would feel at home.
Yeah.
And then I was talking to him, and I realised that his experience growing up and what he was involved in his work in the city, he had more in common with some other guys worked in the city, and they would be to help him settle into church life. He would have more, you know? Yeah. And so you can make a presumption that, okay, you're Nigerian, let me introduce you to other Nigerian people in the church. And I'm looking at myself thinking, why am I doing that? Yeah. It's just a natural reflex to help people feel at home. But actually, once beyond his the fact that he's of Nigerian descent, actually his life is lived with, you know, in a very diverse atmosphere within the city.
I was going to ask, in the course of doing what you do with the church, are there any kind of particular lessons that stand out, you know, moments, experiences, people that kind of have really taught you a lesson as you've kind of developed your ministry?
Things that embarrass me?
Maybe, it could be. Whatever you're willing to suggest,
I'm
really.
To say. I think, you learn a lot. And I think you have to be open to learn all the time. Every week, you see something new that you didn't think about. And it just comes at you. I mean, the most embarrassing experience goes back some years in my Tottenham days. And it was a couple who had just had a baby and said, oh, Pastor, are you going to bring the baby to church on Sunday? And I thought, oh, that's great. And they turned up on Sunday, but they turned up already for a christening, a blessing, as we call it.
Oh, right.
A dedication with all the family and everything.
Oh, goodness.
And I hadn't planned for that.
No.
And, I mean, now I would just go with the flow, but then I just froze and thought, oh, we haven't planned this. Because I didn't know that coming to church, I'm bringing a baby to church, the first time they bring it to church means that they're going to want the blessing straight away.
Blessing,
because English people take months to figure
to
these things
to get round and to
come to
plan it meticulously.
Times.
Yeah.
So I think that was my most embarrassing moment that I tell, and I still feel the pain of that. But I always say to people, I travel the world through the people I meet. And I found that I find people, I'm thinking of my friend from Argentina, and I sit and talk with him, and I learned so much about his experience of coming into a different country, of having to learn the language, and of studying and of building a career, of getting a house, and seeing it from his perspective, and learning about Argentina and the way the church in Argentina, which is very fervent and growing, you know, very...
Yeah.
But seeing his perspective as he's cross cultures.
Yes.
And becoming, in a sense, seeing some of the good sides, but also some of the downsides of church in Argentina. Yeah. And then also bringing that critical insight. Yeah. And I find people of cross cultures often are able to set themselves apart to be more self-critical of your own culture as well as
many people
step into.
Won't have had the opportunity that you've had to immerse yourself in a variety of different cultures. They may live in a fairly monocultural kind of setting in their part of the country, surrounded by people who are essentially the same as them. What can Christians do in that environment, say in a church, where they're aware, I want to be more open, but I'm aware that I don't have the opportunity? Are there practical things you could do? Is, you know, would you recommend a church, you know, do a pulpit swap with perhaps a church... a black church, say, and a white church pulpit swap, or doing something to kind of just change things up a bit.
Yeah, I think people don't live as monoculturally as they think they do a lot of the time. I think, yes, you hear, oh, we don't need to think about this because we don't have any people from other countries around where we live. I mean, that's becoming increasingly less so in Britain. But even if you do, like in... For myself, from Hartlepool in a monocultural area, actually, when you scratch below the surface and begin to ask people, well, you know, who are the people that you've met in your life from different countries or nationalities? People sometimes have something in their a grandparent was from this country or that country.
Yeah.
They may have been to university and come back, and they may of interactive people. You put on the television and you're interacting with influencers from around the world. You read the newspapers and these issues are always on the front of the newspapers. And you're making opinions. You're having opinions from what you read in the newspaper. Yeah. So you do live in a multicultural world, even if you're living in a monocultural or appear to be living in a monocultural village or town or city in the UK. And I think to become aware of that, actually, that you are immersed in a multicultural world, even though on the face of it, it may not be as obvious, I think is important to note. I think as well, I mean, again, churches through mission, you know, churches usually support mission organizations that serve people abroad. And I think we can think about how we approach that, because sometimes it can be very patronizing and we're not really treating them as an equals. We've seen it. These are people who we're going to help.
Yeah.
But then everybody who goes on a mission trip comes back and says, I learned so much more than I could ever give these people. So I think how we think about world mission and supporting world mission, it's allowing it to impact us and shape us as well as we may be trying to offer help in practical ways to others.
Well, Malcolm, thank you for being my guest on The Profile today. Malcolm Patton, again, Senior Pastor of Black Horse Road Baptist Church in Walthamstow and author of the new book, Leading a Multicultural Church. If you're interested in multicultural ministry, perhaps there's someone you know who would benefit from reading this book, do get hold of it, available via SBCK or Christian bookshops online and so on. But thank you for being my guest on today's Profile, Malcolm.
And thank you for allowing me to come and join the conversation.
You're very welcome. My name's Justin Briley. You've been listening to The Profile, and we'll be hearing part two of today's programme in just a moment.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second half of The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. The Profile brought to you in association with the magazine I edit, Premier Christianity Magazine. And if you'd like to read a feature on the Great Divide, on the racial segregation that continues to exist between black and white churches in the UK and what we can do to unify them again, featuring these interviews with Israel Olufinjana and Malcolm Patton, then do go and read the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine. That's at premierchristianity.com /free sample to get a free sample copy of the latest magazine. My guest in this section of the programme is the Reverend Israel Olufinjana, a Baptist minister who hails from Nigeria.
Tell me a little bit of your background, Israel. Did you grow up in a Christian family?
Yeah, grew up in a Christian family back in Nigeria. Grew up in what might be regarded as an African independent church family. So we go follow my mom to church every Sunday. And so I grew up in that Christian family, but didn't commit myself until I was 17. That was when I committed myself to becoming a Christian. So it was like following my mom, my mom's religion, but at 17, I adopted this as my own faith.
Yeah.
And then from there, start getting involved in Christian ministry.
And did that start in Nigeria?
Yes. Back in Nigeria. We're talking about 20 something years ago now.
Was that a fairly kind of Pentecostal kind of?
Yeah, Pentecostal background, Pentecostal experience. Getting fired up.
Yeah.
And very exciting and passionate. Yeah. So yeah, those are my roots. Nigerian Pentecostal.
So what brought you to the UK?
I came as a missionary. I came in 2004 to plant a Pentecostal church in the UK, as well as to further my theological studies, to do a master's degree in theology.
Sorry, when was that? In
2004.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so those are the two things that brought me here. And yeah, I was going to go ahead and do the church plant. But then as I began to observe the church scene in London, just going around different churches, particularly African churches. I saw some things that I liked, and there were some things I saw I had lots of questions.
Mm.
And I was kind of thinking, if I planted that church, it possibly might just be one nationality.
Mm.
And I was thinking, if God has sent me here to be a missionary, then it is important to contextualize.
Yeah. What was it you didn't like about the churches that you saw?
Well, I felt having a church in a place like London that is cosmopolitan, it's good to have a multi-ethnic, multicultural church rather than monocultural church where maybe a Ghanaian leading a Ghanaian church or a white British leading a white British church or a Nigerian leading a Nigerian church. I understand the reasons for that, but I kind of felt what God has called me to do is different from that. And so I wanted to be involved in a multi-ethnic, multi-context.
A truly multi-ethnic.
Multicultural church. So I left that church plan. I didn't carry it through and decided to look for an existing English church. So I went into a Baptist church in somewhere in Southeast London and then get involved there. It was a multicultural church. It had about 60% white and about 40% African and Caribbean. And so that was my sort of learning curve and first exposure to a multicultural church. And then later became the minister at that church.
Yes. So what was the name of that church?
Crofton Park Baptist Church. And so I became the first African minister there in its 100 years history.
Well, yeah, the first ever, I assume.
Yeah, first ever. Yeah.
So what were some of the challenges going into a church which was obviously had a heritage which was obviously predominantly white?
Yeah.
How recently had it kind of adopted a slightly more multicultural feel?
I think Crofton Park is known to be a welcoming church because since around the 60s, when Caribbeans started coming into the church, they were very welcomed. And then from about 2000, you began to have African families coming. By the time I left, there were more African families coming in. And now I think there's more Asians in the church. It was a welcoming church, so I think that really helped. And the church leader was very helpful, very open, very welcoming. And I think that's the key ingredient in if you want to develop a multi-ethnic church.
Yeah,
there has to be that hospitality, that welcoming, or else it could choke the life out of the different cultures. But that welcoming means it's saying to you that you are welcome. There were challenges.
Yeah, what kind of challenges?
I think there were some people who said I probably have. Obviously, I have a Nigerian accent. That's not going to change overnight. So some people said they struggle to hear sometimes when I preach. While you understand, obviously, what they mean, obviously, it's still kind of not easy to handle. Things like that. And at times just be misunderstood and things like that. So there were those challenges that you will find in any multi-ethnic setting.
But
it was worth it to be in that context.
Many churches, perhaps most churches, tend to be where you tend to find one ethnicity gathers. And it could be argued by some that works because, you know, if you're, say, a predominantly Nigerian congregation, you're kind of gathering around us as well as gathering around Christ, you're also it's also a shared cultural identity, so it's natural to have a leader at the front who is also from that culture, that identity, and so it's a kind of it's a natural thing. It's not something we should be too worried about. It's just the way it is because churches do naturally kind of tend to attract, you know, in those different kind of cultural. But do you think that's that's not a good argument.
I think arguments in favor of monoethnic or homogeneous church principle, you know, has been proved to be effective in terms of church growth. That when you have a visionary leadership and that the majority of the people there share some a commonality with the leadership, it tends to grow, and you know, and I think there is a case for that, but I suspect that in places where I think we might have a multicultural context, such as, say, London, Birmingham, I think in such places, I think it is important to seek to be multi-ethnic, to be multicultural, to just go beyond one culture. That might be a good starting point, but I would hope that we want to move and progress. And equally, the same will be for a white majority church in London, because there are still white majority churches in London and in Birmingham and Cardiff and other places, that we almost seek to transition. We have to ask the question, who are the people in our locality that are not in our church? How can we make church accessible? Or how can we bridge the gap so that we can connect together? So I think we have to look at our demography. And then I believe in the biblical vision of Revelations chapter 7. But oftentimes when people talk about Revelations chapter 7 and the vision of all tribes, every nation and language, it actually started from Genesis. Started from creation story. God created diversity, as far as I understand the creation stories. And that is the vision that underpins Abraham's call to the nations. God changing his name from exalted father to the father of nations. It's the DNA of scripture, and so we can't ignore it.
I mean, coming back to the issue of say, a black church pastor, perhaps from Nigeria, Caribbean, wherever, that who is leading a, say, predominantly white church. Now, that's a relatively rare phenomenon.
Yeah, that is.
Firstly, why is it so rare? And secondly, I guess, for me, a question that arises, and I don't know if you ever encountered this, would be, some people who are sceptical of that might say it's difficult for a predominantly white British congregation, say, to be led by, say, a black minister from Nigeria, because the cultural differences are going to kind of be very obvious, and there's going to be, like, there'll be kind of lots of missing each other, you know, in the ways that you're bringing things across, and that's not the way they're used to things being brought across, and you're not used to the way that they respond. It's not the way that it would happen in your own culture. So, yeah, just some of those issues. What do you think?
I think in those kind of contexts where you have an African leading maybe a white majority church, I think, there are cultural as well as theological and ecclesiological and missiological factors that one needs to consider. Cultural because, you know, we're talking of ethnicity. At the end of the day, we are all human beings, so that we have to start from that point, but we have differences of the way we say things, and whether we like it or not, our culture shapes the way we interpret the scripture and see the gospel. We all have cultural lenses that we bring into the way we do church, and so when you begin to filter that, that begins to impact how things can be. So, for example, someone coming from an African, say, West African background, it's a culture of respect. Where, for example, you don't address the pastor or the leader by their name.
You always say pastor.
You know, you say pastor. Or, you know, you don't just call them by name because of that culture of respect for authority, whether parents, anyone older than you, or an elder or something. Whereas where we are in terms of British culture, calling someone by their title is not really the in thing. You just call people by their names, first name term. So there could be a kind of a misunderstanding there. If you have an African pastor who expects people to address him or her by the title or at least show some respect, and then people are just treating him like, hello, mate, that sort of thing. It's kind of like, okay, this is different. And so it's negotiating things like that becomes very tricky. That, you know, and also theological, depending on which kind of church background people are coming from. Say someone is say the African pastor is coming from a background where he believes in prosperity gospel. That could cause a whole lot of because from our understanding of the English culture, at times we don't like to talk about money, mm-hmm. whereas an African wants to talk about money, because it matters. So you have again that theological cultural distinctions where one wants to talk about money because they think it's important, and one feels, oh no, someone is one of those things we don't talk about. It's reserved.
Is there any kind of, or have you ever encountered any kind of racism in the church specifically?
I think, yes. I think oftentimes when people talk about racism in the church, people often refer to the 60s. But actually now there's still racism today because we are still sinful. And so I've seen comments that at times people make, either out of ignorance or maybe not fully understanding what they're saying, but whichever way, you know, there's nothing you would put it down to, like, okay, that's, I'll tell you a story. There's a story in one of my books. This is based in Ireland, and there was this missionary who is from Brazil, and he came as a missionary with Latin link to Brazil. I mean, from Brazil to Northern Ireland. And they were doing a lot of ministry in a particular church, and they were attracting a lot of, you know, ethnic minorities in that particular area. And they were having kind of like drop-in center for, you know, people were coming to do English classes, and they were having a drop-in center for children of those migrants coming in. And one of the things that was said by the people in that church was that they don't want to allow some of their children toys or beaks to be used by the migrant children because of contamination. But the way they worded it was like, oh, black children kind of thing. And you know, this is kind of like tension here. This is not 1960. We're talking of 2004-05 recent experience. Another one. I've got a friend who lives in Kent at the moment. He's looking for a church, and he's been to several places, and oftentimes his family has not been accepted. Because they look different. Basically. They've even been told to go and find another church.
I mean, I was going to ask, how explicitly is it just that no one wants to talk to them, or is it that they literally get
that's
told?
That's it. No one talks to them. No one talks to them. And we're not talking of one church, several churches. These are stories. These are true stories. These are people that I know. And these are still some of the things that we encounter today. In
how given that this does still exist, like it or not, in churches, what steps for a church that perhaps has begun to recognize, well, we may play lip service to, you know, equality and wanting to be welcoming to everyone, but it's just not happening, and we don't look the same, say, as our the neighbourhood around us, for some reason. How do you begin to change that?
I think there has to be a culture of intentionality. So it's not enough to just desire it and pay lip service to it. It's got to be intentional action. And which will mean that you have to be proactive.
What kind of thing would be
You have to look out for people. So if I give an example, in my current church, Woolwich Central Baptist Church, I intentionally look out for new people. People who are coming for the first time, we intentionally look out for them, either by during the service asking if anyone visiting for the first time. Obviously not everyone likes to do that. We understand that, so we don't put pressure on anyone. But also after the service, making sure that everyone that comes that is new, they have a conversation with someone. And I try to find out who they are and say hello to them, and it, where possible, even write a letter to acknowledge that thanks for coming on Sunday, hope you come and visit us again. That's one way of being intentional. Another would be, you know, finding out, for example, in your area, going back to what we said earlier, who are those people out there that are not in our church? So we have about 17 nationalities represented in our church, but there are still some nationalities not represented that are out there. So Woolwich, where we are, we have large Nepalese, we have Somali, and we have Vietnamese. Now, you know, these are nationalities that we don't have well represented in the church, and we would love to. But it all starts by just being conscious and just being, there's something that, you know, Baptist pastors are asked to do, the mission audit. That is, what is your church doing? What are you providing? And what is out there in the community? And then match it together and see where the gaps are. That has been intentional. That is seeking to gain some understanding so that you know what the needs are, so that you can see how you can begin to put actions into address it. Because if you don't know, you're just going to be aiming for nothing. And so you need to have an intentional plan and, you know, go about it.
We know that over the last several decades, immigration to the UK and, if you like, second generation people who've grown up in the UK as well, have formed some of the largest churches in the UK by a denomination like RCCG or something like that, or individual churches like Jesus House in London, Kingsway International Christian Centre, New Wine in Woolwich, and those sorts of places. Large congregations, but primarily black congregations. And so there's, I think that kind of maybe feeds into the idea that you can have very large churches, but it seems to, you know, the natural kind of course is that they tend to be aiming at a specific kind of culture and background and so on. And you don't see that many, I could be wrong, of those churches that are really growing, that have a really truly diverse kind of congregation. Why is that, do you think?
I think there is something here we need to firstly understand. If I take some of those big churches, for example, I think what a lot of people might not realize is that from an outsider's perspective, everyone in those churches look black.
Right.
But there is diversity in blackness.
Sure. Yeah.
And at times I think, you know, when I look at KICC or New Wine in Woolwich, where we are, I look at those congregations. You see on Sunday, everyone that goes there looks black.
Mm-hmm.
But actually what that does not tell you is that there are people from different parts of Africa. And so within those churches, diversity already exists.
More diversity than often is in,
that often is
in the,
than often
in the
than
white
appears.
Majority church as well.
Because people have come from different places. But because the term black is used as a blank canvas, that is not seen. And so in those kind of churches like KICC, they actually have lots of nationalities, lots of, you know, people from different social status and background. You know, different tribes if they're from Africa. And when you put all that together, it's actually, I actually think we need to rethink the term black majority church and change it to black multicultural church. Because of that point. Because I think that is the case in many of those churches. There are some churches that you go in, it's majority Nigerian or majority Ghanaian. But equally, there are those you go, there are Ghanaians, there are Sierra Leoneans, Cameroonians, people from Ivory Coast, people from Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania. All these people are different. I think there is a question that both white and black churches are wrestling with. And that is the question that, why is it that white British don't no longer go to church? It's a big question for all of us. And I think until we begin to tackle that question as churches together, I think we'll probably continue to polarize because it's a big issue that we need to look at. That why is it that just white British people are not interested in church any longer? And we have to also be take it further, working classes. Why is it
that why is they it are a middle not, class
exactly
sort of church that essentially exists.
Because
yeah.
the way I see it, you know, looking at the church in the UK, it appears overtly white, middle class.
Mm.
And so we have to ask all those questions. That why is it? Where did the shift happen? Why are we where we are? And I think this is where all these fresh expressions of church, incarnate network from the Baptist and Pioneer Network and other things are beginning to address some of these questions about, okay, we need to think in terms of missional communities or in terms of fresh expressions of the church. How can we have a church in a pub? How can we do a church in a pub? You know, to begin to bridge those gaps because if people are not coming to us, then surely we have to find ways of connecting and going to them. And that's something that black churches have to work around as well. We all have to work around it.
Do you think the future is truly multicultural, though, for the church? Do you feel like it is going in the right direction? Do you see churches increasingly emerging that do feel like they have a genuinely kind of multicultural feel?
Yes, I think it is. I think especially some of the churches being started by those second and third generation, they want to do things differently from their parents, or if they are, you know, involved in some of those new expressions of churches, they want to do it differently. And so I think as UK continue to be multicultural, because it will continue whether we like it or not. And, you know, all those other places that look maybe very white at the moment, people are moving out because of London obviously being expensive.
Mm-hmm.
People are moving out. And as people begin to move out, you know, everyone we have to come to terms with, we have to just think multicultural, multi-ethnic. Because when you think of the face of the church in the UK, it's multicultural. And so when you think of the mission context in UK, it's multicultural. And to address a multicultural context, you need a multicultural missionary movement, which is the church in the UK. And so because of that, you know, how do we reach out to the Hindus? How do we reach out to the Muslims? How do we reach out to those communities out there? How do we reach out to atheists, agnostics? So you're definitely going to need a multicultural missionary movement, which the church has to emerge and tackle, because that's the mission context in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've been listening to The Profile with me, Justin Brierley. If you'd like to listen again to today's programme, you can go online, premierchristianradio.com/The Profile, where you can also find links to the podcast of The Profile, an easy way to listen to the back catalogue of interviews while on the go. And don't forget, you can find our feature on the great divide between black and white churches and how we can unify them in the March edition of Premier Christianity magazine. Go online and ask for a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/free sample. I've been Justin Brierley, your host for The Profile. Look forward to being with you again at the same time next week. Right now, time to hand over to Dave Rose with Premier Playback.
Wondering if dangerous contaminants are in your home's water? Get Leaf Home Water Solutions today. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make it safer and healthier. Leaf Home Water Solutions is offering a free in-home water test. Just visit leafhome.com/water to schedule yours. With results from their advanced digital testing, Leaf Home Water Solutions can design a whole home system and expertly install it in as little as one day. With Leaf Home Water Solutions, you can feel confident that each drop of water from every tap and appliance is cleaner and safer for you and your family. We can't live without water, but we can take actions today to make our family's water safer with Leaf Home Water Solutions. Schedule your free home water test today at leafhome.com/water and save 15% on all home water treatment systems. That's leafhome.com/water for your free home water test and 15% off. leafhome.com/water.